This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. It feels like summer. It's time for shorts. Short pants? How about short segments on today's show? Nothing on the show today is longer than 5 minutes, and some aren't even a minute long. Let's see how many segments we can fit into the show. Installment number one comes from the very first season of Yin Radio in 2006. In October 2006, the Women's Center at the University of Idaho hosted a live show. It was a collection of performances on feminist topics. It was called The F Word Live. Some of the performers came into the studio in the following week and performed their work. This is Cecilia Alcala. She was live in the studio on November 6, 2006, with some slam poetry. Cecilia Alcala, she is a senior in sociology, anthropology, and justice studies at the University of Idaho, and she's the president of Lambda Theta Alpha, the Latina sorority. She performed a couple of her pieces at the F Word Live on Sunday, and she came into the studio to read them for us. We're very fortunate to have you here, Cecilia. Why don't you take it away?
Okay. Women of Juarez, Mexico are dying left and right. They work at the maquiladoras and soon are out of sight. They're found with missing body parts, burnt, strangled, and raped. They try to resist, but only a few escaped. The victims and their families are silenced in many ways. Sometimes they're missing for months, weeks, or days. But does anyone really care? Some say it's their fault for working right there. Maybe it's because of the clothes that they wear. Or maybe she was flipping her hair. This is what's wrong with our society. It becomes an issue of them versus me. Why can't I wear whatever I want? Why don't they understand I don't wear this skirt to flaunt? My clothes and my outfit's part of who I am. I wear what I want because I know that I can. Why does society assume women are trying to please? Why are we treated as second-class citizens, as if we're just a tease? We're treated unequal. Society tries to keep us on our knees. We get paid less than men and much less if you're a minority. What happened to United We Stand and equality? Like the women of Juarez who don't have a voice, sometimes we're treated as if we don't have a choice. The women of Juarez have to work there to survive. They're forced to work long hours, late nights, and their end soon arrives. Why doesn't the government do anything at all? They're also the suspects, so who do we call? We need to stop blaming the victims for their pain. They're scarred up for life and they're still getting blamed. This is what's wrong with our society. It becomes an issue of them versus me. The U.S. gets rich at the expense of the poor. Nobody cares. Society calls her a whore. The government says she must have been living a double life. She deserved to get battered. She wasn't a good wife. It is her fault for wearing that skirt. If she didn't want it, why'd she wear that tight shirt? She chose to work at the maquiladoras for $4.50 a day. Despite sexual harassment, she decided to stay. People need to understand it isn't her choice. From the moment she's born, she's neglected a voice. Being female means you shut up, you listen. Being female means a lot of ass kissing. The women of Juarez, like the women of the USA, are affected by male dominance and exploited every day. The governments of these countries don't give her any respect. They say it's her problem, so what can you expect? Why should she get rights? She should be a domestic. That's why battering continues and males don't get arrested. People assume we're feminine, nice, and neat. We will cry for everything, but we must take the heat. We were born to suffer, to strive, to prove people wrong and fight to survive. We can't be too sassy, but can't be too prude. Can't be too nice, but can't be too rude. With double expectations, how can we get things right? Society says do one thing or another. It's a constant fight. This is what's wrong with our society. It becomes an issue of them versus me. We focus on what the victim did wrong, instead of the perpetrator who was to blame all along. So why is it that we don't help the victim out? United We Stand is what freedom's about. These women aren't free, and neither are we, when we fall in the trap of this victim-blaming mentality. This is what's wrong with our society. It becomes an issue of them versus me.
Thank you so much, Cecilia. I know you're running on your way to class, so we're going to let you keep running. And again, thanks for stopping by and sharing what you shared on the F Word Live. That was from November 6, 2006. It had been performed live in the studio, the Women of Juarez. From Feminist Poetry to Feminist Research. Installment number 2 is an excerpt from Pam Bettis' keynote speech at the 2007 Athena Women's Leadership Conference in Moscow, Idaho. Dr. Pam Bettis is a researcher at Washington State University, and she had been looking into the power of nice. She and her colleagues are studying how being nice and the pressure to be nice affect professional women.
The stories I'm going to present are drawn from women who work in a variety of positions in the academy, including administrative staff, technicians and science labs, faculty, teaching assistants, grad students, and administrators. They are drawn from women in the Northwest and in the Southeast. They are Black, white, Latino, gay, and straight. So far, we've only interviewed about 35 women, and our goal is 100. So our very preliminary findings suggest that women in the academy fall into three camps in their understanding of nice. And as we read their stories, think about what they're saying. I want you to start positioning yourself. Where do I fall in these three camps? Or maybe I don't at all. This is the first group. Many women in our study would strongly endorse the idea that being nice maintains women's subordination and that it adversely impacts women in the academy. Most of these women did not consider themselves nice, and they did not think that their coworkers would consider them nice. Further, they all experienced how not being nice in their jobs detrimentally affected them, or how being too nice at some point earlier resulted in their being taken advantage of. These women recognize that women are expected to be nice, and nice is reflective of a particular type of femininity that determines the standard by which all women are judged. This is a typical response from this group of women. A lifestyle that I can't have, can't do, won't do, can't be. Now, here's a respondent that harkens back to how nice has been associated with a type of femininity that is not only compliant and servile, but also one that literally does not take up too much space. You've probably heard countless women lament that they didn't want to, I don't want to take up too much space in a meeting or in a conversation, in the belief that those actions are overbearing and egocentric. So generally, for this group of women, being nice is about being superficial, compliant, overly eager to please others, and taking up little space. According to this group of women, nice has not only been seriously detrimental to women's ability to be successful in the academy, even more importantly, it's negatively impacted their own capacity for self-actualization. For these women, a focus on nice meant losing a sense of self, one's confidence, dignity, and worth. This understanding of nice, of course, harkens back to those earlier meanings that we talked about, as women being ignorant, simple-minded. In this understanding of nice, nice guys and women do finish last. So these women aren't concerned with being nice at their jobs. They are far more concerned with being seen as competent and as someone to be reckoned with. The strategies they employ demonstrate their dominance are reflective of what has been generally seen as a male model for getting along in the workplace. They speak up. They challenge others. They get in people's faces. They criticize. They argue. And they don't let anybody mess with them. However, this approach to nice doesn't mean these women are immune to the pain and frustration they felt as a result of the backlash against them for not being appropriately nice. They were. Now, these participants told numerous stories of how their speaking up, challenging others, getting angry, putting their own personal agendas first, had serious consequences on their work life, from negative evaluations on annual reviews, a monthly slap on the hand from the dean, to doubting one's professional abilities, and in one case, for a woman who lost her job. They were quite vocal in their analysis of the gendered nature of nice, noting that their male colleagues are not subjected to the same negative evaluations as they are for their lack of niceness. And here's an example of how women regulate others in being nice. You do have a little bit of a temper. Now, ultimately, to be successful in the academy, these women would argue that proving your competence and your social dominance, traits long associated with masculinity and the male model of getting ahead, are much more beneficial for women than being nice. Here's a faculty member explains the lesson she was taught from a male department chair. Certainly, one reading of this model for success, don't be nice, is that these women are proof that women, if given the same opportunities as men, can achieve success in a world dominated and controlled by men. They are proof that if they are smart enough and savvy enough, they can win the game. An alternative model might question why success has to mean adopting a masculine model, a masculine way of being. Is it possible for women to be successful in the highly competitive culture of the academy without emphasizing social dominance and downplaying communal or relational caring? Can a woman be nice and successful? The second group of women say yes.
And that was Dr. Pam Bettis, keynote speaker at the 2007 Women's Leadership Conference. Later, we'll get to hear about those women who say, yes, we can be nice and get ahead. Now, at that same conference, University President Dean Thomas talked about getting ahead in the academy. Installment number 3, Dr. Dean Thomas.
Administration is, believe it or not, not a popularity contest. Although it is the kind of situation where I keep telling myself it's not a popularity contest, and then I keep behaving as though it is. Because it is so important to touch base with your constituents, to know what they think, to share with them your thinking. And while I can make decisions that mean people won't like me, I don't like it. I still prefer to be liked. You know, not being liked is tough.
The theme of this Yin Radio show is summer shorts. We're already up to installment number 4, and it's something completely different. It comes from Alex Thornburg, who was a Yin Radio intern in 2007, and this is his essay about skateboarding and conflict.
To some people, skateboarders are seen as hooligans, menaces to society, and even criminals. Sure, there are those who fit into the aforementioned categories that also happen to be skateboarders. But isn't there people like that that fit into those categories who happen to be a lot of things? There aren't as many people these days who still cling to this common misconception of equating skateboarders with criminals, but there are a lot of those out there who still do. Recently, some local skateboarders were assaulted by a faculty member at the University of Idaho. One of them was skating as the others watched and one filmed. Before getting a chance to even make an illegal ollie down the stairs, she started yelling for them to leave. He replied, "I'm just looking." After finishing her smoke, she went inside, only to emerge later on a rampage, trying to pull some wrestling moves on them. First, she shouldered into one of them. As he bewilderedly tried to help her up, she told him to F off. Then she jumped on another's back, scratching his neck and drawing some blood, screaming, "You effers." She called the police on them for skateboarding. After seeing the footage and talking to another witness, there was no denying what really happened. But throughout the whole ordeal, especially when the police first arrived, they were overbearing and held preconceived notions of the skateboarder's guilt. Near the end of the whole ordeal, one of the police said, "Well, you know you aren't supposed to be skateboarding here." The skateboarder who the woman attacked didn't press charges, and in fact, I don't believe he was even asked if he wanted to by the police. But if it would have been the other way around, I can assure you there would have been charges pressed. It would have been a much bigger legal ordeal. The incident even happened at the law building. Imagine if this situation was the other way around, with a skateboarder attacking a faculty member. There would have been people in handcuffs, front page headlines, and a cross-campus uproar. Well, I just want to make it clear that I don't think all law professors are crazy, full of hate, and in need of a serious reality check. Just one. And I don't want to put a campus-wide ban on the teaching of law. But if this situation was the other way around, skateboarders would not have gotten this same courtesy. One thing I do want is for people to understand us skateboarders as people doing what we love. amidst all the laws and all the regulations in place stopping skateboarding and trying to confine it to one mundane, fenced-in area. I want people to see that we are being forced to not do something that defines who we are. Skateboarding has changed my life, has shaped my life, and done so for many others. Skateboarding is more than a sport, more than a hobby, even more than an art form. It's all of these things and more to us. Skateboarding is what I do to escape stress. It's the reason I got into my field of study. It's the reason I met most of my friends. It shows up in my art, my writing, my photography, my filmmaking, and now, in this radio segment. Think of the most important thing to you, the thing that you can't live without, and then imagine it being taken away from you. This is how we feel on a daily basis. But, as it has in the past, and as it will in the future, skateboarding will live on, it will persevere. No matter how many laws prevent it, and no matter how many people hate it, skateboarding will continue. And that's the beauty of it.
That was Alex Thornburg. He's now a graduate from the University of Idaho in communications. Alex was an intern at Yin Radio when he wrote and produced that segment. You're listening to Yin Radio, and today we have shorts. Lots of short pieces. We're up to installment number 5, and I call it The Voice of Authority. It's from my interview with Beck Christensen, a corrections officer in an all-male prison facility.
You know, you don't question my order. This is how it is.
Let me also ask you real quickly about, we talked a little about language, and I hear it cropping up, and that's interesting.
Yeah.
But what about use of voice? Did you have to learn to use your voice differently? You have a good voice anyway, or do you just have to project it to make it powerful?
Well, if I'm on one side of the compound and I see something going on the other side of the compound, I've got to be able to do that. But that's also part of that whole identity thing, too. I can be down by Echo Dorm, which is down by the rec yard, and see something going on up by Center Gate, and all I have to do is do this. You know, there's body language that I use with them, too. And because they know it's me, they know they need to do what they've got to do. So I don't necessarily have to even use my voice a lot of times. It's just a presence that you have. I'd like to think that I don't. He may say differently. But I'd like to think that I don't use the same voice at home that I do at work. Because I'm not a woman at work. I'm not a mom at work. I'm an officer. I'm in a sense genderless. Even though they know I'm female, in a sense I'm genderless, and so the voice that I use is an officer voice. I can't...
So it is an officer voice?
It is an officer voice, absolutely. It's matter of fact, you know, and that's part of the whole thing. Your eye contact is very important. If you don't give them eye contact, and some of them see that in a threatening way, particularly if you're a woman, but I have to do that because I have to establish that I'm the one that is calling the shots here. So I have to give them eye contact. And sometimes it gets into a staring contest. It really does. And it's difficult sometimes. Some of these guys are pretty big. And even if they're not, you know, that doesn't mean they can't do you some damage. So I've got to be careful about that. And that's, you know... It's really difficult to convey to someone who isn't there really the nature of what you do, like anything else. You know, it's really hard to do that.
Well, it's hard for a lot of us to imagine putting ourselves in that position and saying, okay, I'm going to figure out how to do this. It's a role and mannerisms and, I mean, everything that goes with that role that we're not used to assuming in daily life. Like I said, when it comes to voice, I had to learn in meetings how to not do this when I got
I really wanted to make a point. That voice just doesn't make your point. But, you know, I'm upset, and this is how my voice goes.
Mm-hmm.
And instead to bring it down and be right. very direct and say the same words, perhaps, but say them in a much stronger and clearer tone.
Right.
And, like you said, eye contact right. and things. And if you're not taught that, it seems hard to learn to take it on.
Some of that they cover in training. You know, but really and truly, like anything else, really, like anything else, it's on the job. I think the only difference between this job and this respect than any other job is that you can lose your life, or another officer can lose their life, or an inmate can lose their life, or get hurt, or whatever. But it's like anything, you just learn. You learn by watching, and hopefully what you're learning is what you need to be learning. There's going to be officers just like anybody else anywhere that are not worth emulating, that you shouldn't emulate. But you look for the best, and you look for people that you respect and admire, and you look at consequences of their actions. But ultimately, you have to find your own way of doing things, your own identity. And your own strength. This job has given me much more confidence than I had before.
In general?
In general. Absolutely.
That was from my 2007 interview with Corrections Officer Beck Christensen. Installment number 6. We're moving right along here. This comes from St. Louis, where I met an Indian woman who lives and works in Puerto Rico. Tapulshi Ghosh is an astronomer, and she works at Arecibo, the largest radio telescope in the world. Tapulshi Ghosh, international astronomer.
My name is Tapulshi Ghosh. I sort of halted a little bit because I'm from India, and my name is actually in India is pronounced as Tapulshi Ghosh. But since it's spelled as T-A-P-A-S-I, everyone here calls me Tapulshi. I can't blame them because that's how it's spelled in English. But the actual pronunciation is Tapulshi Ghosh. That's my name. Mm-hmm. And I was born in Calcutta in India. And I studied there until I did my MSc, Master's in Physics, from Calcutta University. Then I did my PhD in physics, in astronomy and physics together in a city called Bangalore in India. And I worked with the radio astronomy group there. I was up in the mountains in the southern India in a very beautiful place. And so I was working there. I finished my PhD. Then I went to a postdoctoral fellowship to Holland. I spent 2 years there. And while I was still a student, Chris Salter, who was a scientist, astrophysicist from Great Britain, he was visiting my institute. So we met there. And then he went to a job to go to West Virginia, work for NRAO, and I headed off to Duinglo, a little village in Holland, again to work with radio astronomy, radio telescope. But at that point, we decided we didn't want to live so far apart. We wanted to get married and find a place somewhere together. So we were looking for 2 radio astronomy jobs, which wasn't easy to come by. So for a year we looked, and then we turned up, you know, the Arecibo Observatory, which is actually an NSF-funded institute and a national facility. They were looking for astronomers there. So we both got 2 positions. My husband got the position to be the head of radio astronomy group, and I was hired to be what is called friend of VLBI, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So we both got positions there. At the same time, they offered me a position at Chris's old institute at Green Bank in NRAO. So they didn't want to let Chris go. So they wanted me also to be there. Well, I think for that reason, because they didn't really know me at that time. But we decided to take a new challenge and go to Puerto Rico. So since then, this was in 1992, since then we've been there, and it's been an exciting time because when we went there, the telescope was going through a big upgrade. So we got to do a lot of hands-on work with the equipment and have our say in how this new telescope is going to be.
Well, let me ask you about your role now.
Right.
You said that you are...
what's called, at that time, I'm still doing this sort of similar job, although I did many other things before. It's called Friend of VLBI. VLBI is I'll expand that out, it's acronym for Very Long Baseline Interferometry. When my job particularly is that to basically starting from looking after the equipment, we need special equipment for that. When I started up, we bought new equipment. Some part of it was inbuilt within our observatory by our engineers. So I'm sort of in charge of putting it all together. And people put in proposal to observe. So when they come, when those proposals get approved by a peer review process, then I have to make sure that the observations happen. Very often, most of the time, I and other people also, and also my husband sometimes together, we run these observations because sometimes they are just like one after the other, so you need reprieve.
Well, let me ask you about being a radio telescope. Do you run observations like 24 hours a day practically?
Yes, absolutely. So day, night, anytime we may be called to do observation, whenever it's our time, or for my case, if anybody else is doing the VLBI run, I have to go and run it for them, make sure they get all the calibration data, they got good data, any pre-setting, peer testing, all of that I do, and then send that data out to the users.
So do you ever get any rest?
Well, it's sure I do. No, that's one thing is I'm one of the lucky people who gets to do something that one enjoys for a living. You know, this is my hobby plus my job. So that keeps us going. If you can combine both, then that's really the best combination.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Okay, you are very welcome.
That was international astronomer Tapasi Ghosh. Now, another scientist, Jane Goodall, and perhaps you've heard of her, talks about what animals have taught her in installment number 7.
I'd been in Gombe about a year when I went to college, and I was a little scared. You can imagine, can't you, going to do a PhD when you have never been to college at all. But I was excited, too, because I had all this data and I wanted to know how to analyze it. So you can imagine it was a bit shocking to get there and be told that I had done everything wrong. I shouldn't have given the chimpanzees names. They should have had numbers. It was more scientific. I couldn't talk about their personalities. That was unique to us. I certainly couldn't talk about them having minds capable of any kind of thought. That was also unique to the human species. And as for talking about emotions, I could not talk about chimpanzees feeling happy or sad or fearful or filled with despair, because these were unique to human, and attributing emotions similar to this to non-human animals was to be guilty of the terrible sin of anthropomorphism, attributing human characteristics to non-human beings. Well, I suppose I should have been utterly intimidated by all these erudite professors with all their statistics and years of study. But you know, I thought back to my childhood, and now I come to the next individual who played such an important role in who I am today. And all through my childhood, I had this extraordinary teacher, and he absolutely taught me clearly that animals had personalities, that they had minds, that they were capable of thinking, and that they absolutely had emotions and feelings. Who was that teacher? My childhood companion, my dog, Rusty.
Jane Goodall, she did her research in Africa. Installment number 8 coming up next is about Africans in America. Peter Chilson is a writer who enjoys exploring the interactions between cultures.
I'm very interested in clashes of culture. And not always clashes, sometimes cultures just meet and cool things happen. But this is just a brief excerpt from an essay I'm working on. It's not published. It's about something that I saw when I was in my hometown in 2002. I grew up in Aspen, Colorado. And I was back there for my mother's funeral in 2002. And one day, to clear my head, I went out cross-country skiing. One morning in 2002, in the last days of winter, I was poling through a bony forest of aspen and fir on a cross-country ski track I knew would break from the trees and circle miles of meadow. I'd trained and raced on this ground in the 1970s at the base of a mountain outside Aspen, Colorado, where I grew up. Now, after years away, I followed the track across terrain reshaped by many huge new homes. This is a ski town, after all, and it's logical someone would preserve the course. The houses had great picture windows, wraparound decks, outdoor swimming pools, hot tubs, high stone walls and chimneys, and they stood on land that had been for me a vaguely wild place, the domain of bear, deer, coyotes, and in winter of skiers like myself. Sunlight still stumbled through branches, casting bright and fractured stains on snow, just as I remembered. As I came around a corner a few hundred feet through the trees from one home, I heard voices whose intonation sounded like Bambara, a language of West Africa, where I've traveled and worked for many years. I skidded to a stop and listened, peering through the trees at three coal-skinned African men on a deck in parkas and ski caps. One shoveled snow, carefully dumping rather than tossing each load off the deck, while the second man stood beside a blue plastic tub of cleaning liquids and rags set on the deck railing. The third, hands thrust in his jean pockets, sat on a bench and did most of the talking. I realized they were the help. The resort town term is houseboys. And I listened a few minutes, understanding nothing. I don't know Bambara, but I speak French, the language of one of West Africa's former colonial masters. I shouted, "Bonjour!" The men stopped talking and gathered at the edge of the deck to peer back through the woods at me. A tall figure in a blue windbreaker and black ski pants. They said nothing. I waved and shouted, "Assalamu alaikum," an Arabic peace greeting common in the Muslim world, which is to say, throughout West Africa. I hoped they would invite me over, but the men looked at one another, exchanged words, and hurried inside the house. They left the plastic tub on the railing and the shovel lying in the snow. I stared after them, feeling foolish. The men were far from home in a place so different from their dry, impoverished homeland that my greetings must have made them suspicious. Maybe they thought I was an immigration officer. I skied on, touring the meadow and wondering how these men, in search of a better life and means to support families, had managed to leave their desert home and enter a country so increasingly paranoid about its borders. I was curious about the risks they'd taken and how they'd survived. 2 hours later, I returned to that house, hoping to explain myself and welcome the Africans to the Rocky Mountains, where the sun is as dangerous as in the Sahara. But the deck was empty. Fearing trouble with their employer, I didn't knock on the door.
Author Peter Chilson. This Yin Radio show is a collection of short pieces on subjects all over the map. We're up to number 9, and it is poetry. Liz Branfield takes us to the water as she reads her poem called Endurance.
And this poem is called Endurance, and it's inspired by the long-distance swimmer Lynn Cox, but it really has not that much to do with her. It's called Endurance. There's a woman now swimming the English Channel or the Bering Sea or across some other impossible water between unimportant shores, miles of it. She sips from cups extended over the waves on a pole. She cannot hear voices and measures time in breaths. I'd love to see her entering the water, capped and suited, greased for the psychological edge of speed and warmth, and to save her skin from the pickling brine. I'd love to see her stumbling out on the other shore, knees unused to weight, buckling. Of course, this is how I see love. Something of endurance and unreasonable calm. Harder to attempt once you've known the numbing tiredness, the unrelenting salt, the safe boat unable to gather you up if you want the miles to count for anything. And you wade in anyway.
And you wade in anyway. Poet Elizabeth Branfield. We have more water in this 10th installment.
In the summertime, water becomes more than a resource. It becomes a playing field for swimming, boating, rafting, kayaking, and tons of fun. All of these activities require one basic skill, swimming. I did an around town with the question, do you know how to swim? And here are the answers I got.
Do you know how to swim?
No.
No?
I doggy paddle.
Really?
Yeah.
Why didn't you ever learn?
I took swimming lessons when I was in kindergarten. And I was like a swimming school dropout. I couldn't do it. So I doggy paddle now. I mean, I don't think I'll die if I put in water. I'm not going to drown. But I can float on my back and stuff. So no. Can I still learn?
You're,
I don't know.
You're never too old to learn.
Never too old. Maybe. I don't know. It's never been an issue.
My mom put me in swimming lessons when I was early. I was like a little fish in water. I had a cute little pink swimsuit. And like, they have home videos of me, like jumping off the diving board and being like a little fish. Now I'm not really that into it. I mean, I know how, but I don't like go swimming for recreation.
Do you know how to swim?
I do. I started when I was 5 or 6 and kept taking swimming lessons until I was 12.
I do know how to swim. I learned when I was little, but I'm not very good at it.
Do you like it when you learned it?
Yeah. Except for the fact that I'm kind of really sensitive to chlorine. So that was entertaining.
Do you know how to swim?
No, not really.
You never learned?
Yeah, I learned, but I'm not that good at it. I could save my life, but I don't think I could do it competitively.
Do you know how to swim?
Yes, I do.
How well?
Well, let's see. When I was in third grade, I was on the swim team, Vista Diablo Dolphins in California, and that was a neighborhood, so everyone had to learn how to swim. But I was a really good swimmer at a young age, so I don't know. I can't remember learning how to swim. I've always swam, so got the bronze medal, actually.
Nice.
That's the lowest honor. Yeah, and then I was also on swim team when I moved back to Elko, Nevada. I was on swim team there, made it for a day, couldn't hack it. So yeah, I also tried out for a lifeguard.
Wow.
Didn't make it. But I can still swim.
When did you learn to swim?
5 or 6 years old.
Yeah? How did you learn?
Took lessons.
You like them?
Yeah.
Do you swim a lot?
I used to swim a lot. Not anymore. Not for you. It's last time I was in the pool was in 2006 in California. But I don't swim a lot at W. Sierra Pullman now.
Do you know how to swim?
Yeah.
When did you learn?
I think in first grade.
First grade? Did you like swimming?
Did I like swimming? It scared me. I didn't want to put my head under water. I used to cry.
Do you swim a lot?
In the summer. Not in the pool though. I like the river.
That segment was from Anna Maria Roque, who just finished her stint as a producer with Yin Radio, as she's now graduated and she's moving on to a new job in Amsterdam. Now here's another Around Town compilation from Anna Maria.
When I say grandma, what's the first memory or image that comes to mind?
Right now, my car. Because I was like, how do you like that grandma car? Yeah, that's what comes to mind, the car, the grandma. Buick Lucerne.
Sex. No, I honestly walked into my grandmother having sex once. I'm not joking.
You were raised by your grandmother.
Yes, I was. I was 5 years old, maybe. It's like the first image of sex that I have in my mind. I walked in and, yeah. So yeah, that and rice, beans, steak, and mashed potatoes.
Is that what you make?
My mother.
Your mother is my mother.
Yeah.
She's 73.
Your mother is 73.
Yeah, with 11 siblings.
She's like, five.
Are you the youngest?
No, I'm like middle.
There's three
below me.
How old's the youngest?
10.
My grandma's 5 foot tall, and my grandpa's 6 foot, I don't know, three, and she knocked him out with a frying pan one time.
Why did she do that?
I think he was wasted and mouthing off, and Grandma didn't like that too much, but I asked Grandpa what happened to his head, and he said he got kicked by a horse, so that's my memory of my grandmama. My fond memory of my grandma was every Saturday, she'd take us out, and she would take us, you know, out on, I guess, the red wagon, because they were popular in, like, the 80s. Anyway, my favorite Saturday activity was when we were acting up or being bad, she would set us in front of the TV, because that, you know, cures little kids from being bad. And one of my favorite memories is watching Calamity Jane, which is still today my favorite movie ever, with Doris Day. And that is one of my favorite memories of my grandma.
When you say grandma, I think of when I was in preschool and I was being teased by my classmates because they said I said gamma, and I said grandma, and so I went up to my grandma and said, gamma, I don't say gamma, do I, gamma?
When I say grandma, what's the first image or memory that comes to mind?
Well, I was with her last night at a basketball game, and it took about 20 minutes to get her up the stairs. It's kind of funny because there was about 400 people behind me trying to get by, because we got to walk her up with one arm, and drives the women crazy.
Oh my gosh, my grandmother in the kitchen making biscuits.
Biscuits.
Yes. She made them every morning for breakfast for my grandfather. I don't think I ever spent a day in their house that she wasn't up at 5 o'clock in the morning making biscuits. She made biscuits every morning because that was the work that she did in their household. Was she happy with that? I don't think so. She was an avid reader, and it was from her I got my love of reading. And I think that given a different century and better education for her, that would not have been her choice. She was very good at it, by the way. She was a really wonderful teacher. So for her, there was some, I think, some creative impulse behind the food that she made. So it wasn't entirely that it was just her job. It had a creative outlet aspect to it. However, someone born in a different century, again, with better education prospects, I don't think those would have been the choices she made. I honestly don't.
When I think of my grandma, I think of how when we play cards, she has a really dirty mouth and she doesn't apologize for it. She just, like, talks a bunch of shit, and it's awesome.
Grandmother? Mm-hmm. Being slapped in the butt.
That's what your grandma did?
Yeah, because that's just the way she disciplined your grandchildren. My grandmother's kind of ruthless. She's grew up on a ranch, so.
So, my grandma, my other grandmama, number two, she was Catholic and really devoted Catholic. So devoted, she got kicked out of a few Catholic churches. But other than that, she used to make me go around and put holy water around the house. And I guess I don't really know, like, what holy water does. And I used to like to, you know, drink it. But she used to, you know, make me go in the basement and have this little, like, it looked like a microphone. It was weird. And she'd make me do it twice, and then go to each room and say, like, a Mother Mary, but I can't remember what it was now.
We've done 11 installments, and it's not over yet. Installment number 12 goes back to the beginning of the show with the topic of feminism. Next up, Dr. Amy Canfield teaches, among other things, pop culture and women's studies. Here's Amy Canfield talking about the word feminism.
Feminism has become a bad word in American society. And young girls, specifically young women in their 20s, deny being a feminist. But they adhere to, or they believe in, a lot of feminist ideology. So I'm Jessica Valenti, the author of Full Frontal Feminism, is the one who came up with the I'm not a feminist but syndrome. where girls will say, I'm not a feminist, but I believe in social equality for women. I'm not a feminist, but I can see that there is still a wage gap for women, and it needs to be fixed. I'm not a feminist, but I think that domestic violence laws need to be strengthened. And so I want to examine where this came from, why young women are denying being something that they should be proud in being. And I think that it comes from, A, the backlash against feminism in the 1980s and 1990s, where it became a bad word. B, the belief that feminism accomplished all that it needed to. And C, a change in American girls at this point. I teach the survey level American history class here, 1877 to the present. And when I get to the women's suffrage lecture, I always ask my students, how many of you are feminists? And every year out of a class of 65, I get maybe one or two students raising their hands. And I'm always shocked by it. And then when I do my lecture on the women's movement in the 60s and 70s, I ask it again, and sometimes I get a few more. And I want to know why girls, young women, don't want to be called that. So I ask them all to close their eyes and tell me what a feminist is. Tell me who she is. What does she look like? And I get answers, you know, oh, she doesn't wear makeup. She doesn't wear skirts. She has very short hair. She's a lesbian. She hates men. She never wants to have children. I get those types of answers, and I say, some of those are probably true. Oh, and she doesn't shave her legs. That's always her favorite. And then I give them the definition of feminism, just the basic definition. Feminism is the belief in social, political, and economic equality between the sexes. They hear that definition, and it's really hard to fight against feminism if you hear that. Who's going to say, no, I don't believe in that. That's a horrible thing. But they still really don't want to acknowledge that they're feminists. And then they'll throw out, well, feminism's been successful. And when I point out, the wage discrepancy is always my biggest point of evidence. The most recent report is 80 cents on the dollar. Women make 80 cents on the dollar for what men make with the exact same educational background and experience. Clearly it hasn't accomplished it. Domestic violence rates are always going up. That's a symptom, I think, of feminism's failures. Feminism was very successful in bringing attention to domestic violence, but it hasn't solved it. And then I ask them, does it matter? Does it matter that this word has become a bad word? If people still believe in the tenets of feminism, do they have to call themselves feminists? And I hear that they have to. Why should you be embarrassed of something, you know, if you believe in it? And one student said, I agree with feminism. Maybe we should come up with a new word for it. But why should we have to come up with a new word? I think that there's a larger problem in society that we would need to. We have a word for it. It's become a bad word. Let's take that word back. Let's re-liberate feminism. Make it a good word again.
Professor Amy Canfield. Susan Power graduated from Harvard Law School, but she doesn't practice law. Susan Power writes fiction. In installment number 13, Susan Power talks about not being a lawyer.
Okay, I really did think I was going to be a lawyer. You know, I wouldn't have invested all that time and money and all that hell. The Socratic method can be a really scary thing. And So I really gave it a legitimate try, and at least, you know, I got my degree. But a lot of us discovered we hated it because it's really a game, and you have to love the playing of the game. If you are somebody who really is fixated on outcome, and you know, then you're in the wrong. You're sort of in the wrong line of work, and it made me a little bit cynical. And I also, you know, I'm just this artist, this crazy artist, and being in a business suit all the time, just I don't know. But a lot of my fellow students did the same thing. They became, one went to London and became an actress and has done quite well there. Another became a therapist, a veterinarian, They've done all kinds. A filmmaker. So, you know, we figured, okay, we've spent all this money. We've trudged through being good campers, getting good grades, being nerdly, doing all this work. And it's all, we're very privileged and lucky to have this chance. And I'm totally mindful of that. But it's meant to give you more options, not close them down. So, okay, since we are very fortunate, why don't we take advantage of that and follow our passions instead? So that's what some of us did. And so I'm really glad I did. And it's funny, the last time I worked as a lawyer, it was a very large law firm in Chicago. They took up the 72nd, 73rd, 74th floors of the Sears Tower. And, you know, I made friends there. I liked people, but I hated it. I just hated law so much as a practice. My last day of work, I did this happy dance. We had these banks of elevators, and I'd gotten to know the receptionist really well, and she knew all my angst, and I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I did this dance just up and down this hall because I was so happy that I was free. And she said, "You will not ever be a lawyer, will you?" And I said, "No."
That was author Susan Power with some music by Joy Harjo. Susan Power made a major change. Motivational speaker Nancy Hunter Denny wraps up this Yin Radio show with an endorsement of change.
I mean, be open to the concept of change. Be willing to say, "I admit, I'm not perfect yet." Be willing to change. I really believe that people can change that quickly. I believe firmly in the concept, friends, that at any given moment we can make a decision. We can make a decision to do something differently. We can change our attitude, we can change a behavior, we can say yes, we can say no. In any given moment, being on the top of the food chain, we can in fact become better people.
Nancy Hunter Denny, from a keynote speech at the 2008 Athena Women's Leadership Conference at the University of Idaho. Well, we did it. Brought you some summer shorts. 14 installments in 1 hour. So let's end it with some short songs. Let's start with Daisy May's Housewarming Party.
Was our housewarming party, but Jimmy burned the place down. We got married, I was pregnant, we just had a few friends around. I got chatting, he got drinking, we kind of forget where we were. And Jimmy cooked me kissing a local guy, and for Jimmy that was bad enough. His eyes were firing a million fires, and everybody started screaming. We all rushed down the staircase, but Jimmy sat there.
Ready for a change.
It came upon a midnight clear, that glorious song of old, from angels bending near the earth to touch their harps of gold. Peace on the earth and goodwill toward men from heaven's all-gracious King. The world in solemn stillness lay to hear the angels sing.
That was the strong voice of Alison Krowe, who makes all her music available free at alisoncrowe.com. Next on our short music, as we're wrapping up this Yin Radio on Summer Shorts, is Eva Milan with Fine del Mondo. We're going to follow that with Holy Water by Janie Snyder as we sign out on today's show.
Lasciarsi dondolare dal destino è uno scherzo in confronto al superfluo che ci ha sotterrato. Favola allucinogena, pagine bianche, la strada di casa è un gioco d'azzardo. Per vivere una giornata vera basterebbe un miraggio. Aspetto che arrivi la fine del mondo a liberarmi. So please take this water to my home, 'cause my child is dying all alone.
Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show, Summer Shorts. You can listen to past shows or podcast this show, or you can sign up for electronic newsletter from Yin Radio at yinradio.org. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and on Facebook. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Opening music is by Piano Chocolate. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation, and I thank you for joining me.
Put me in jail. So here I am, hey, hard to see, stuck inside a cell and got no keys. And I'm still worried for my son, 'cause they told me was nowhere to be found. The house was empty, but I'm sure it's still around. So please.